listening to In the Name of God from Kingdom Come Trust in Belfast, Northern Ireland, an international faith-based show comprising music, news and interviews from all over the world.
Hi, I'm Raymond McCulloch. Welcome to our 15th In the Name of God show. We have music for you today from Georgia and Texas, USA, and from British Columbia, Canada. And also we begin a two-part interview with Dr. Kieran Martin from Delhi, India. We also have our usual faith-based news feature, Bread News International. You keep on sending us very encouraging responses to our show, which we really appreciate. You can find these on the feedback page of our website. We started the show today with an Irish tune from David Lineweber in Georgia, USA, called Whiskey Before Breakfast. Not that we're advocating such a diet, but Irish tunes do have strange titles sometimes. And we'll have more good music for you in a minute. But now let me introduce my guest for this week, Dr. Kieran Martin. Kieran lives in Delhi, India, and began the ministry of Asha, which means hope in the Hindi language, more than 21 years ago in the slums of Delhi. Her work has brought her into contact with the Indian government, major banks, and with criminal slumlords straight out of Slumdog Millionaire. I interviewed her when she visited Hollywood County Down a few months ago.
When did you qualify as a doctor, first of all?
I qualified in 1985 from the University of Delhi. By 1985, I'd actually completed my residency in pediatrics.
And you're from Delhi originally, are you? Or?
Well, I was born in Mumbai.
You were born in Mumbai?
Yes, that's right. And I lived there for the first 11 years of my life. But then I moved on to Delhi and I've been there ever since.
And you became a doctor in Delhi?
Yes, I did. Yes, I completed my high school in Delhi. Went on to first studying medicine and then went on to doing pediatrics.
I know India is different, but did you have sort of a fairly middle-class background, a fairly well-to-do background?
No, I was from a middle-class background. My grandparents, they came from undivided India back then, before right. India got its independence. But because they were from a Hindu background, they felt threatened living in what is today Pakistan.
Okay.
And so they came to Mumbai as refugees, you know, leaving everything behind.
Right.
And that then they found their place in Mumbai over the years. But my grandfather was a lawyer, my dad was a lawyer. But I am the very first doctor in my family.
Congratulations. Tell me then, from that background, you wouldn't have much experience of the slums of Delhi. That would not be your natural habitat or somewhere that most people would want to go even. Is that right?
That is right. Because, you know, Delhi has about, today, about 14 million people in it. Wow. And out of those 14 million, about 4 million people live in slums. Now, you see these slum colonies dotted all over the city. But people from middle-income families or even wealthier families would never even dream of setting foot in a slum area.
They would just drive past, would they?
They would. And they might be seeing them from the window of a five-star hotel or something, you know. And as you just go drive along the city, you would see them here and there. It's just not the done thing for anyone else to actually set foot inside.
I think it's just the same in the West, actually. We just close our eyes and what you don't see doesn't impinge on you.
Yes.
So how did you become aware of conditions in the slums or why on earth did it have this effect on you?
I come from a Hindu family and I just came to know the Lord when I was 18 years old.
How did that happen?
I actually was invited to a Youth for Christ camp back then.
Right.
And it was really wonderful the way God revealed himself to me. Because
why did you go? I mean, as a Hindu,
yes.
Did you not sort of feel they're trying to get at me or something here? Or did you feel that?
No, not really, because I was invited by a friend.
Yeah.
And it sounded really interesting.
So it was a relationship, so you already knew some people?
Yes, I knew someone and that person invited me and I went along. And I just sensed the very real presence of God at the time. And I just gave my life to the Lord on the last day of that camp. And since then, I've actually never really looked back because I just was so overwhelmed by the kind of transformation that happened within me.
Yes.
Through having gotten to know Christ, that I just decided that I wanted to follow him.
How did your family and your parents particularly react to that? Were they a bit upset about that? Or?
Yes, they were. I mean, you know, when you're coming from a Hindu background, it's seen as something that, a step that is alienating you not only from your religion, but from your culture, from your family, from your roots, from everything that you stand for, you know, in your family.
Have they changed in their attitude over the years? Or?
They have, because it's now been 21 years that I've been working in the slums and they've seen the fruit of my labor. And they've seen all the different things I've been doing. And they at this time, there is really no issue at all about the fact that I'm a Christian.
The Hindu outlook on life, would it be normal for Hindus to do what you've done? going into the slums? We'll come to how that started in a minute, but this would be a normal thing, or do you think it's really because of your Christian commitment that you've got involved at all in that?
I think it would be very rare, because we have the caste system.
Yes.
In the Hindu religion, and you have...
You
don't cross the divide, and people living in slums are often from the lower castes, and also people who are outside the caste system, and those people are known as untouchables. And so people from Hindu families would find it really difficult to mix and mingle with them, or even see them as equals, really.
Yeah.
Because if you really want to help slum people to come out of their poverty, the first thing you have to do is treat them with equal dignity. And that is something that does not come naturally to a Hindu family that is well-to-do.
Or to most selfish individuals who are most of us around the world. How long then after you made a commitment to the Lord did this whole idea that became Asha, how did that come about?
Well, when I was studying medicine, I would basically look after a whole lot of poor patients in the hospital because it was a government
hospital. Part of your training?
It was part of my training. And then even later, when I continued to do my residency, I felt I should gain a lot more experience before I moved out on my own. It was mostly poor patients that I saw. And I used to go as a volunteer to slum communities, even while I was studying. And I was very clear. The Lord just kept impressing on my mind. It wasn't like a flash of lightning, or there wasn't anything very dramatic that happened on one day at one moment.
It grew on
in
you?
Time. It just grew on me. And I just felt that this is what the Lord was saying to me. And through the many, many verses in scripture, through his own life, I felt that I must model my life according to him. I must model my behavior according to him. I must be able to demonstrate the same kind of generosity that he did and the same kind of unconditional love towards all people that he did.
Were there any verses that kind of stood out in scripture that kind of backed that up for you?
Yes, I mean, we know the famous verses in Matthew that talk about whoever did anything for the least of these, my brothers did it to me. And that showed me that Jesus was saying that if you honor the poor, you're actually honoring me. If you're insulting the poor, then you are insulting me. If you're ignoring them, equally you're ignoring me. You can't really say that you are doing everything for me and you are worshipping me and at the same time ignore the poor, because the two can't go hand in hand.
Whenever we like a willow. Follow you every step I take, and bend like a willow so I don't break. That's why the horse has got a bridle. That's why a dog is on a chain. I never seem to learn my lesson. You have to teach me yet again. Bend like a willow. Bend like a willow.
A bouncy wee song there from Debbie Zebick from British Columbia, Canada. And bend like a willow.
Bread News International.
In this bulletin, thousands of Aboriginal people converge in Ottawa, Canada, and Nepal Church is growing despite persecution and tensions. Jerry McCulloch reports.
Report from Worthy News Asia Service. A Christian advocacy group, US-based International Christian Concern, said that Nepal's churches are experiencing unprecedented growth, despite reported political turmoil and persecution. ICC reported that an increasing number of people turn to Christianity in Nepal at a time when the Asian nation faces turmoil, including a strike by the Maoist Party. The organization cited research from mission group Build International Ministries as proof that the Nepali churches grew from a handful in the 1950s to denominations with over 100,000 active members today. Churches are growing by leaps and bounds everywhere amid difficulties, added BIM President Sandy Anderson, who spent the last 25 years working with Christians in Nepal. Despite the difficult situation, the church continues to thrive. His comments referred to the overthrow of the country's long-reigning Hindu monarchy in 2006, ending a 10-year Maoist insurgency. Christians have reportedly rallied to express their desire for both religious freedom and dialogue between opposing sides. Over 25,000 Christians gathered on the streets of the capital, Kathmandu, for an unprecedented celebration of Easter Sunday, ICC added. On May the 23rd, the anniversary of a deadly 2009 church bombing, Christians rallied to express forgiveness towards their attackers. The persecution has driven the people in the church to their knees, Anderson stressed. Yes, there are threats. There is persecution, torture, and intimidation. Any time you become a Christian, you face immediate persecution, even from your own family members, he said. ICC's regional manager, Logan Maurer, said the reported growth of the Nepali church, despite uncertainty and persecution, remains an example to churches worldwide.
Thousands of Aboriginal individuals assembled in Ottawa to release the forgiveness that Prime Minister Stephen Harper requested in 2008. The Prime Minister concluded his apology for Indian residential schools by requesting the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly. At that moment, says Chief Kenny Blacksmith, the onus was placed on our people as individuals to respond. The only way to come into our full healing as the First Peoples of Canada is to forgive. Forgiveness is not political. It cannot be bought or sold. It cannot be legislated. It is an individual choice that can break the generational cycle of victimization and accusation. Blacksmith met beforehand with Prime Minister Harper, who could not attend on account of international obligations, but has been very supportive and addressed the summit via video on Saturday. The National Forgiven Summit came out of the vision and leadership of Chief Blacksmith, a residential school survivor, former Deputy Grand Chief of the Grand Council of the Crees of Quebec, and founder of Gathering Nations International. Vision is not reactionary to the past, says Blacksmith, but we have to release ourselves and others from the burden of the past so we can look with hope to the future. Chief Blacksmith, in the company of youth and elders from across the country, presented a Charter of Forgiveness and Freedom to the Government and People of Canada. Authored by residential school survivors, elders and youth, this charter was signed by Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal adherents and witnesses throughout the weekend. Indian Affairs Minister Chuck Strachel was present to accept the charter on the government's behalf.
More information on these and other Bread News stories at kingdomcome.org.uk/news.
And let's hear from Kieran about her work in the slums of Delhi.
So how did ASHA actually come about then? I mean, you had some experience of the slums through your training in the government hospital. That didn't mean that you were automatically going to give your life, as it were, to involvement in the slums, which you obviously have done. So how did that come about practically?
When I finished my training, I had some more experience in hospital-based clinical work, and I felt that I was well equipped to be able to now move out on my own. I actually went around the city looking for one of the worst slums that I could find. And I had never really stepped inside something that was as bad as what I did in the year 1988. It was the month of August, the monsoon season in Delhi. There was a cholera epidemic going on because there wasn't enough clean water for people living in the slums. And so when I went into this slum, I just got the shock of my life, because even though I'd been volunteering, I'd never seen an area like that ever. Because there was no road. There was nothing but slush everywhere. There was nothing but garbage everywhere. The stench was so powerful. I just found a little fence, you know, and I was able to jump it and come inside. And I had this old suitcase, and I had all these free medicines that my friends had given me. And I just went in, and I just found a little place that the slum lord had given me. In the slums, you have a lot of these.
Now, when you say a little place, do you mean a building like we're used to? A room or a shop front or an office, or what sort of place did you have?
No. It was just an open space. It was a little courtyard just outside his house. So he just gave me a broken table and a broken chair. And he said, well, this is the only space that I have in the whole slum. And he was right, because I noticed that every little bit of land in the slum had a slum hut on it. And it was someone's home. So that really was the only open space that I could sit and use.
I've seen some of the photographs. What you're talking about here, to try and get Western people to imagine this, is something like a rock festival, only it's permanent. A rock festival in the rain, you know, with all the mud. Are there no actual buildings, or very few?
No, there wasn't a single building.
Not even proper tents, they're just little...
Just small bosses, shacks, huts. And in fact the shacks didn't even have any proper covering. You know, there are holes everywhere, you know, and there was just plastic, there was straw, there was cardboard. Imagine a shack being made out of cardboard, really thin cardboard.
That's in the monsoon?
In the monsoon. I mean, it was often I would see them just collapse and fall to the ground, and then they would just be trying to somehow erect the shack all over again. And,
you know, soggy cardboard.
Sticks, soggy cardboard here and there. You know, it was dark inside, really dark. And if there was a pregnant woman and I would have to examine, I obviously couldn't examine her out in the open.
Yes.
So then I would be given one of those rope cots. You know, you have four sticks and then you have these ropes sort of that have been woven together. And it's like, this is the kind of cot that a lot of them would use to lie on, you know, and just sags in the middle. So they would just give me that, and I would have to go in the dark into that hut, and I would use a torchlight to try and see something, you know, because it was very, very primitive. One wouldn't have thought that people are still living in the dark ages in a way like that.
So it was like ministering in a rock festival in the mud and rain in the dark.
Yes. I mean, okay. I've never been to a rock festival, but I mean, you describe it in a way that
you've probably seen all you need to see.
My sweat would be falling on the ground because the temperatures would be around 40, 41, 42 degrees Celsius. It was really humid, you know, and I'd just be sitting there and I'd be seeing like hundreds of patients because everyone in the slum was sick. It was amazing because they all had illnesses that you could easily prevent. There was really no need for them to be sick with all those illnesses.
But there's no one interested, really, no one from the government or no one from churches or anything else who ventured into that area?
Absolutely. I mean, when I went in, that slum had already been there for 20 years.
What reaction did you get? I mean, there were people, slumlords, crime going on, all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
How did they take to your presence in the slum? Were you seen as a threat?
Yes, I mean, I was seen as a threat because normally people like me, first of all, it was a very alien concept for someone like me to go in. It's something that they didn't ever, it had never happened. And usually the people who really control the state of affairs in the slums are the slum lords, who have to make sure that the slum dwellers vote for the party that is paying the slum lord to do his job. He's on a salary from the political party, and it's his duty to ensure that the votes are cast in the favor of that party.
So these people have a vote, but it's kind of controlled by the slum lord.
Exactly. They would never ever have make an informed choice of any sort.
Right.
So here I was, you know, in the middle of all this with the slum lords realizing, oh my goodness, there's everyone going to her. We're being ignored. People don't want to know who we are. And they're flocking around her from morning until evening. and she's helping them, and then they want to tell her all about their different problems, because I had a listening ear, and you know, they would talk to me about all the different problems they faced. So he really, really did feel very threatened, and it's a very common thing for slumlords to actually, once they realize that there's someone there who's genuinely interested in helping people, to create lots of problems for a person like that, so that they just leave and go away in frustration.
So is that what happened? Did they try and make life difficult for you then?
Very difficult. They created all sorts of problems. And especially because right in the start, of course, I was basically looking after healthcare. Now, that was not as threatening because I was a doctor. There were sick people. They were coming to me. I was giving them medicines. They were feeling okay.
We can live with that.
You know, they could live with it even though they didn't like it, because popularity went hand in hand with that. And that bit they didn't like. But the moment I started listening to them with relation to their other problems, such as housing, such as the need for clean water, such as the need for sanitary services.
This didn't go down so well?
That didn't go down well at all. And especially things like slum housing. And I started helping the community members to organize themselves. And I started teaching them how they can lobby politicians, how they can lobby the government to be able to articulate their demands in a non-confrontational and peaceful manner. And those things didn't go down well with the slumlords at all, because it was completely at loggerheads with their approach.
Uncovering my disoffend, Anumkara, we meet again. Out on the highway at Comfort's Bend, into the ocean where the river ends. Anumkara, my dear soul friend. As you draw close, I see your face. In your eyes, I feel memories of a vow we made to always recognize. I will remember you here in time. Anumkara, we meet again. Circle of friends, kindred spirits in the house of things. You know me better than I know myself. I tell you everything I say to no one else. All the longing and the wanting different from what we truly are. An old connection brought to life, a song that lifts the heart. So friend, a vow we made to always recognize. I will remember you here in time. Down on the highway at Comfort's Bend, ocean where the river ends. Anumkara, we meet again and again. Anumkara,
that was Sheikh Russell from Texas, USA, and Anumkara, which is the Irish for soul friend. Now to find out how Kieran survived the anger of the slumlords.
Did it come to a head? Did they confront you, or did you have to go and pay a visit to the slumlord?
Yeah, they would create problems in many different ways. For example, they would demand that if a slumlord's child was sick, they would want me to get up from the clinic and go and see the child in the slumlord's house.
Leave everyone else.
Leave all the others and go to him. If I didn't do that, then he might come and start shouting, raise his voice. sometimes get violent.
Right.
So, for example, we were once having a meeting of women in the clinic, and we were just helping the women to get trained, you know, and of course that didn't go down with him and his group.
Oh.
So then they deflated my car tires, and they started throwing dead rats inside the car, you know. they broke the window panes, you know,
right.
They threw stones. Then they surrounded the clinic and wouldn't let the women go out back into their homes. They threatened the husbands and said, if these women dare meet again in the Asha Center for any form of discussion, then we'll create trouble for you. So the
right.
husbands then said to the women, don't you go out of the
Stop
house.
Us. And how did you deal with that?
You know, I have had this approach of never rejecting a person, but always rejecting their deeds only in the context of a relationship. Because I think that's what Jesus did. The slumlord type characters are seen in the Bible through the pages
They're
of the
They're still a human being that they can relate to.
And also, they are a product of their past, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
They're a product of their childhood. We don't know what sort of influences were there upon them. Maybe they were brought up in a criminal environment, which is why they've become like that.
Yeah.
And so, for me, the life of Christ was my great model. And he was my great hero, and I wanted to be like him. So what I would do is, and I do this even till today, you know, I just sit down with them and reason with them and talk to them and spend time with them and have a cup of tea with them. Because the thing is that, you see, they're very powerful, but they're hated at the same time. They're a necessary evil. That's what they are. And
so
no one likes them.
They have a need to be loved themselves.
They have a great need to be loved. They have a great need for someone to actually be willing to have a cup of tea with them. Because everyone in the slum shuns them. You know, they might
yeah.
have to listen to them, but they don't want to sit with them.
They're feared rather than loved.
It's feared. They're feared, you know. So when I started opening up with them, then they would tell me all about their lives, and, you know, they would even tell me about their criminal past, and, you know, we became good friends. And I think it was in the context of the relationship that by and by I was able to get through to them. And today there are actually a whole lot of slum lords whose lives have been changed greatly by God's love, and they are very good friends of mine.
Chris?
You've been listening to In the Name of God from Kingdom Come Trust in Belfast, Northern Ireland. If you would like to contribute to this ministry, go to the partner page under radio on the Kingdom Come Trust website. That's www.kingdomcome.org.uk. You can make a monthly contribution or a one-off gift there. Join us again next week for more music, news and more from Dr. Kieran Martin and the work of her Asha organisation in the slum areas of Delhi, India. Slán agus banna tia. Bye and God bless.